afternoon, Arturo.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming before the council.
Pleasure.
We are thrilled that for about the next 45 minutes or so, we're going to be learning a little bit more about you and hopefully learning about your vision of what you can expect if you are appointed to be a regent.
Yes.
As you are aware, we hope to ask you a series of questions. And but before we do that, I invite you to make an opening statement of a few minutes long. And near the ending of the 45 minutes, I'll try to give you some sort of signal that we're getting close to being done with questions, and then invite you to make a closing statement as well.
Okay. So, thanks so much. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm excited to be here, and to be honest, also a little nervous in front of the distinguished group of people, as I'm very serious about the role I'm seeking. During the holidays, I was watching a TED video of Steve Jobs giving the Stanford University commencement address. And in that address, he talked about three stories of his life to that date as to how it impacted them. One of the stories was about connecting the dots. He talked about how some things he did in his past ended up connecting the dots to be where he was. And one of those was after he bailed out of college, he took some courses on his own about calligraphy and how it helped him in the future as he designed the Mac to put the first calligraphy lettering into the arsenal of tools he had, and how he was fired from the company he had started, and how he really, how that experience helped him to become a better leader. So I'm going to do the same thing with you. I'm going to give you the dots throughout my life, and at the end connect those dots to tell you why I'm ready to take on this challenge and opportunity. Just to give you some perspective on my life, I'm going to start from the early times because of the importance it represents for me. I was born to a Yugoslavian mother and a Turkish father in Yugoslavia, the old Yugoslavia. Now it's Herzegovina. And 3 years after I was born, my family, being a Turkish Muslim family, had to move out of Yugoslavia, as my dad was Turkish. And one night, they left everything behind with a few pieces of luggage and put us on a train with my brother and I. I was 3 and he was 7. And we migrated to Istanbul, Turkey, and started from scratch. 2 years into that life, my dad passed away at the age of 42. And I was 5 years old with my mom and my brother. And my mother is my idol in terms of what she has done to raise us. And she just passed away last September at the age of 91. And I went to boarding schools because my mom couldn't take care of both boys, and I was able to gain scholarships and went to boarding schools pretty much all my life. During the summer months, I did odd jobs. I worked for a grocery store. I worked for a carpenter. I worked for a lawyer answering phone calls. I worked for a textile mill. I sold candy and gum on the streets and helped my family as much as I can. And for the college, I was able to get a very prestigious scholarship to go to the only American college in Turkey at the time, called Robert College in Istanbul. Then it was Turkelized and became Bosphorus University. And during that time, I also went to Netherlands, Holland, and did my internship in a shipbuilding yard in Horter, northern part of Holland, and learned about European way of doing things and stayed with the family for 3 months while I was there. As I was wrapping up my degree, it was a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering. And this school was, in our standards here, a combination of MIT and Harvard of Turkey. And my advisor was a Turkish professor who was a graduate of University of Minnesota. And he didn't have to twist my arm too hard to convince me to come to University of Minnesota as a graduate student. And as I prepared to come here in 1976, my family did not approve of my coming here, as I had graduated from the best school in Turkey and had a job waiting for me, and they pondered as to what adventures I was seeking. whereas I was seeking to learn more and be able to understand what the United States is all about, because that's what I learned in the college about the land of opportunity. So I came to University of Minnesota in 1976 within my own means, with $1,000 in my pocket that I had saved through my college years. And my first quarter tuition as a non-resident was $980.68, I remember. I had less than $20 left in my pocket. So I went to the university employment office and asked for a job. They said, would you wash dishes at the Kauffman Union? I said, I can't do that. So I started washing dishes after school at the Kauffman Union. I also found a job as a gas pump operator at the Ryan Station at the University Avenue and 10th Street after midnight. And I knew that if I was able to get good grades, that they were going to grant me a teaching assistantship, which will make me a resident and lower my tuition and also earn a monthly salary. I did real well the first quarter, although with lack of sleep, I had a 4.0 GPA. And they gave me a TA-ship, teaching assistantship, and my tuition went down, and I started to earn $330 a month on my teaching assistant salary. I had it made. And I bought my first car, a 1970 Mustang that had 96,000 miles on it. And I could see the white lanes as I was driving as I looked down at my feet. But It was transportation. So, and after that point, things got easier as I saw the financial challenges. And I also wanted to know more about the Turkish community here because it was very small. And I became the president of the Turkish American Association here in Minnesota and got to help the new students as I was helped by others in my first months or so. And also I got to know the families here. During that time also, I worked for a company called Grocery Wagon in Bloomington as an intern. And this was at the time the first home delivery service for senior citizens. With a phone call, they were able to dial the codes of the items they wanted. And I met a man there that was my boss, Alan Jacobson. And as I finished my thesis and graduated in June of 1978 with a graduate degree in industrial engineering, I was looking for a job. I had an F1 visa, which allowed me to work here for 1 year to gain some experience. And Dayton Hudson came calling, especially at the time, Dayton's. And they were interviewing for a graduate student from industrial engineering who had done his thesis or her thesis on distribution systems. I was the only one. And luck was such that the person that interviewed me was my boss from Grocery Wagon. So I got employed. And that is the time when my 29-year career with Dayton Hudson, Hudson, Marshall Fields, Target, and Macy's started. And in that process, the first 3-4 years, I worked as an industrial engineer as my graduate degree was industrial engineering. And at first, in the big ticket distribution center where we had a warehouse for furniture, I worked with the Teamsters Union. And I was the first industrial engineer assigned to a union shop. And they had asked me to do systems flow, process flow, efficiencies, and also increase service to the home delivery systems. And understanding the challenges at the time, and I believed in collaboration and inclusion. And I met with the stewards of the organization and said, let's work together, and I will lay out everything that I want to do, and you guys help me accomplish this so that we are together collectively is making Dayton's a better place to work for our customers as well as for us. And we were quite successful. I set up delivery systems for the home delivery and increased the number of deliveries from 13 per day to 18 with their help. And during those years, I was elected as the Young Engineer of the Year in Minnesota twice. And Governor Al Quie gave me my trophy at the time. I remember real well, like today. And after some time there, I moved into finance because I had reached my peak as a director of engineering at the age of 28. And I wanted to stay with retail as it was exciting with the change and with the dynamic mix of what was happening in retail organization, and also a very good one at that with the Dayton Hudson organization. And at the time, we had merged the Dayton's and Hudson stores into one department store company. And I started working as the merger specialist. And in finance division, I managed accounts payable, payroll, inventory control, and financial planning. In the next 6 years, from 84 to 90, I helped merge these organizations for the two companies of Dayton's and Hudson's, and learned a lot in that process. In 1990, I was promoted to my key management group as my first job as the director of compensation and benefits. It was an important role at the time with HMOs coming into picture, and also other methods of being able to reduce medical costs and what it meant to the company's bottom lines. And also at the time, we had acquired Marshall Fields. And as a comp and benefits manager, it was my role to let go over 1,000 people from the Chicago office of Marshall Fields. It wasn't a fun assignment, but I did it with pride because it had to be done, and also treated everybody with respect as they moved on. And in that process, I worked with executive compensation. I worked with compensation of the hourly employees. I participated in union negotiations, and also did major benefits programs as a corporation, and worked on some of the medical management methods with HMOs. As I moved on, again, next step was for me to move into merchandising. And our president at the time, Marvin Goldstein, believed in me and took a chance with me and promoted me to be first the vice president and the senior vice president of merchandise planning. That was my first experience in merchandising. But I was told that if you wanted to get to the top, you had to understand merchandising. So becoming a VP of merchandise planning, at first I made many trips to New York and worked with vendors, understanding negotiating tactics, and understanding trends and showroom dialogues with the merchants. And also, due to the planning aspects of merchandising, I needed to understand the psychographics and demographics of the 64 stores we had, anywhere from Bismarck, North Dakota, 60,000 square feet store, $10 million, to State Street, Chicago, Marshall Field store, 800,000 square feet, $250 million. That was the span we were dealing with in terms of distribution of merchandise and understanding demographics and psychographics to maximize our inventory investment. And just about 1994, there was a major change in the Dayton Hudson Corporation. Ken Mackey, our chairman, was ousted. And Bob Orrick came in as the new CEO. And he was a mentor of mine from the department store days. And he asked me to take on a new challenge as the executive vice president of stores. I said, Bob, I've never done stores before. He said, that's the reason why you're having it. I don't want any skeletons in the closet. And your first job is to fire the 6 vice presidents that will be reporting to you the first week. I was younger than all of them. It was a very daunting task, but I needed to understand why. And he said, they're running fiefdoms. We are one company, and your charter is raise our service levels and raise customer service to the top levels of this country, equal or better than Nordstrom's. That was my charter. And although very hard, I let go of those 6 vice presidents and hired 8 new directors. And our first week on the job, we went to Disney World. We went to Disney Institute to learn about their culture of service, the guest culture. Target today still uses the guest acronym or the guest term rather than customer. And we came back after a week energized about the prospects of what we could do. And in that process, I was working with 64 stores, 35,000 people, $3.2 billion in volume, and millions of guests. And I had public responsibilities as I needed to work with the mayors of the towns we were in. And I worked with the unions because we had the only Dayton Hudson department store, union store in Detroit in Westland. And we were able to make it happen because of participation and, again, through inclusion. We went to the table and worked together our challenges and opportunities together rather than keeping them out of the room. And that worked for us. And in 2000, I was promoted to be on the operating committee of Target Corporation. At the time, Target had Target, Mervyn's, and department stores. This was the internal board of directors. And I was able to have lots of meetings and time spent with people like Bill George of Medtronic and Steven Sanger of General Mills, Roger Enrico of PepsiCo, and many others, and learn how to work with the board members, high-level executives, hourly employees, commission employees, union employees, and thousands of customers. And as we moved in this direction, by 2004, we were able to be selected as one of the top three retail institutions in the country by NRF, National Retail Federation, as the top service givers, next to Nordstrom's and other small chain. As we're basking in the sun with all of this glory that we have able to we have been able to accomplish, on my birthday, March 8th of 2004, they announced they were going to sell the department stores. And it was a dagger into my heart. I was at a COO position and getting ready to be a CEO of the department stores, and now they were going to bring in a total new company. And April 1st, a few weeks later, I was also diagnosed with lung cancer at Mayo Clinic. I was facing both and the more serious crucibles of my life at the same time. But I was determined to come out as a winner through resilience and perseverance and believing in what I was doing, and what was happening was for a reason. And I beat cancer, and it's been 9 years. I am free of cancer. And also Macy's came, and I could say I survived with them for 3 years. And I had to leave in 2007 with my head held high, as I wasn't going to be a hypocrite and do the things they were asking me to do, which meant that I would undo brick by brick what I had built for the last 10, 15 years. And I did not want to be a hypocrite and left. And went to work for a local company called Life Touch, which is a photography company. And I was their president and CEO for 3 years. And I was approaching the age of 57 when I decided it's time for me to leave and do something on my own because I had earned my financial freedom. Now, at this stage of my life, I wanted to do something that was important for me, and that was to teach and coach and prepare leaders for the future. With the Enrons of the world and with what has happened with the Andersons and all the public distrust, and I felt I could do my part to be able to raise the future generation of leaders with what I've learned and with the passion and desire I had to raise leaders. So in the summer of 2010, I left LifeTouch and worked with University of St. Thomas. And now I'm an executive fellow and an adjunct faculty teaching leadership courses at the night MBA school and the day school. At the night school, I teach a course called Executive Perspectives. I bring in 12 CEOs to the classroom every week, and they talk about their industry and they talk about leadership journey and teach the students from their own leadership experiences what they learn and what they could leave as lessons. And plus, then I do a leadership exercise with them and a vision exercise for them to create a 5-year vision for themselves as a leader and what they will do as a personal development strategy for themselves. And the day class It's a leadership lab. I work with all the faculty and the staff to combine everything they are learning from marketing, from systems, from accounting, and how that ends up in the leadership arena, and how I can show them to be leaders. And these are younger students. They have about 3 to 4 years of experience versus the nice students have about 10 to 15 years of experience. And I've enjoyed that class tremendously, and I've also introduced this year for the first time after Harvard the True North groups that Doug Baker and Bill George wrote a book about, True North groups, where these students, 6 or 7 of them, meet every other week to talk about themselves and self-awareness and authenticity. And they are in the same time of their lives, and they could teach a lot of things to each other. And that's part of the course as well. And also, I started my own organization effectiveness company to get it to a company level other than schools. And I've been hired by Target and Select Comfort. Now, I'm an organization effectiveness consultant and an executive coach for director and vice president level executives. Currently, I have 14 executives, 7 from each company, that I coach for a full year to help them accelerate their leadership expertise. So that is my professional thing. Along the years, I've talked about, and there is the nonprofit aspects. From my younger life, initially, I was selected to be on the board of Aquatennial. And it was a major Minneapolis festival. And with Target's muscle, we were able to bring in the big OOAH, which is the fireworks show, to Aquatennial. And then I joined National Retiree Volunteer Center, NRVC, as retirees of the companies were asked to join and become productive. And both Target, Dayton's, Hudson's, Marshall Fields had lots of retirees and were able to connect them with this organization. From there, we were representing Target in Detroit. I joined the Detroit Regional Chamber. And I was part of the council that worked on Detroit Renaissance of the city of Detroit. And we brought Fash Bash, now is a glamorama that you hear about every year. And the fireworks, the Thanksgiving parade, and those were things that as retailers were able to bring to the city. And then I was on the board of the Minneapolis Downtown Council and with Sam Grabarski for 10 years. And I headed up the Downtown Retail Council and helped to bring downtown more retail as a result of our efforts. But most important of all, I was recruited by Dave and Linda Mona and Margaret Carson to join the University of Minnesota Alumni Association. And that happened in 2003. For 8 years, I learned a lot from Margaret and working with a great board. And I pretty much did every volunteer job there is to do. I was on the committee and also committee chair for finance and audit, committee chair for communications and marketing, and vice chair and chair-elect. And then when Margaret announced her retirement, I volunteered to work with her on the transition of the leadership from Margaret to the new CEO. And then I was chair and then immediate chair. And most recently also nominating committee chair. And those 8 years were very fulfilling for me as I was able to work with my beloved university. And after Margaret left, it was time for a 5-year strategic plan. And also, I had a new CEO that was young and green. So I rolled up my sleeves and worked with Phil Esten. And we hired NAPA Consulting from California to help us prepare for the next 5 years with a strategic plan. And I involved every aspect of the university from an engagement perspective and partnership, and also the different levels of alumni, not just the members, but different levels of alumni, to give us their thoughts about what was important for their university. And this strategic plan has 3 key focuses: partnerships, its advocacy, and engagement. Partnership meaning working with the university offices and institutions to have laser beam focus on working together rather than against each other. engagement, not the 60,000 members, but 400 plus thousand alumni to be engaged in helping better the university. And of course, advocacy with the legislature in terms of the challenges the university was facing. And most recently, I joined the board of Minnesota International Center as an executive committee member, whose mission is to really have teach the understanding of international cultures and the importance of it, and engage others in experiences and educate K through 12 the international elements. And now it's time for me to bring together the dots that I've talked about and that are connected to prepare me for the position I'm talking about. From a diversity perspective, I bring to the table an international diversity of being born in Europe and being raised Muslim and still a Muslim, but married to a Lutheran Norwegian from South Dakota and for the last 27 years, and have an adopted daughter from Turkey who's 20, who's transferring from Gustavus to the University of Minnesota this year. And so from a diversity perspective, I understand and value diversity of every kind, not just gender or sex, but religion, cultures, and also international understanding. Professionally, with the things I've talked about, I work with every level of leadership, from board of directors to high-level management, to union organizations, working hand-in-hand with them for the common good, and hourly employees, and also developing teams that I feel very proud of. From a teaching perspective, as I talked about most recently, I'm dedicated to help develop the leaders of tomorrow and help teach what is leadership with integrity and with pride is all about. And my wife is also a very big supporter of the University of Minnesota. She was most recently the president of the Goldstein Gallery of the University of Minnesota Design School. So we are a family ready to continue serving the university at a higher level and help it even be better. So I'm sorry I took so long, but I wanted to give you a picture of my past and why I'm here today, and I feel that I am prepared for the challenge.
Thank you. Before we get to the questions, I think it's important that I need to inform you that it's not your daughter does not have to transfer.
Okay. I understand that.
Yeah. So
she's the one that is the one to get.
Okay. Okay. Harry.
Oh, I didn't get it.
Yeah, now get it.
Margaret may disagree with you.
Yes, she may. Harriet.
With your robust international background and global experience, I'm interested in your perspective on how well-positioned the University of Minnesota is in a global marketplace. Mm-hmm. And depending on your answer, what you would change to improve that standing.
You know, probably I'm going to guess this, but 40-50% of the graduate students are from foreign countries. And there's a lot of international flavor in the school. And I think the key element that we may be missing out is the experiences that the American and the foreign students can get together and learn about each other, learn about their cultures, and learn about accepting each other versus just reading what they read in the newspapers and having biases about others due to their religion or due to their culture or upbringing. And as the first-born, foreign-born chair of the UMAA, and I will feel very privileged to be the first foreign-born region as well to bring that thought process and also help create experiences for the students about the understanding of each other's cultures and religions, to better understand each other and respect each other so that they can be better citizens going forward and with tolerance and also with respect for each other's differences.
How would you go about doing that?
As a board member, I'll be part of the governance, not the management. So depending on the committees that the board has, I will volunteer to serve on a committee, especially that is the background I bring, and to be able to work on opportunities. And as we create committees and talk about divergence of ideas at first, but all the ideas possible, that is within the environment we work in and live in. And then through a convergence process, hone into two or three key focuses and hopefully recommend the staff to be able to move forward with those ideas and be a sponsor for it with a block and tackle for it if need be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jerry.
Yeah, I'm reviewing your application. You made this analogy about the baseball team has to play offense and defense. By the way, I think Cubby Smith thinks that's true for basketball, too. But you mentioned about being able to assist the president in achieving his visions for the university. And I'd be interested to see, what is your role in working with the president as a regent to achieve his mission or his vision?
Yeah, president's vision is very clear. As he talked about, learning and teaching is the number one, and then comes research and innovation, and outreach, and also managing effectively and efficiently. To be able to create an effective organization and also find the appropriate funding, both through legislature and also through private donors, to create opportunities for students through scholarships and also for the tuition not to go up as high. As I use the analogy about playing offense and defense, offense are the first three of it. Defense is creating an institution that is effective and efficient and have other means of financing itself. So while controlling expenses and managing expenses, but also at the same time growing and doing research and what this institution as a land-grant university has a mission for. So those are the elements of his vision. And as regents, we need to support that vision and ensure that they stay on track on those elements. And again, as I indicated earlier, be on block and tackle if there's any elements that we could help solve along the way. But they will be the players in the field, and we'll be the coaches on the sideline giving them tactics, hopefully. Thank you.
Lois.
Thank you very much for your introduction. This is intended to be a bit of humor. I'm not bad as a dot person and dot connector, but boy, do I have something to strive for after listening to your opening statement. You did a wonderful job. I'd like to ask a compound question. If one accepts the premise that higher education is critical to the growth and strength of our economy, and that we want Minnesota's economy to be as strong as it can be. The first part of the question is, how, again, I'm going to footnote this. Thank you for sharing your wife's geographic background. So it calls into question all of Minnesota, not just the metropolitan piece, as I ask the question. So how can the university become more effective in, be a more effective partner in the economic development of the state and global economy of the region is part of that question. And I ask it not just looking at the university through the extension outreach piece, but through all of the university connecting. And then as a second part of that, how does the university interface with the Minsky system and the private college system within the state to advance that same goal?
Mm-hmm. I think the university most recently has published a study showing the return on investment. And if I recall right, for every $1 that the state invested at the University of Minnesota, it was over $13 that the return was coming through. And that was mainly through the research and how the research was converted into business opportunities, mainly in economics of the state as well as the human health elements. So there is this tremendous approach, as one of the vice presidents, I cannot remember his name right now, he's retiring and somebody else is coming from Texas to replace him, is the position of trying to convert university research into business opportunities. And there is more to be done there to be able to actually not just research for research's sake, but at the same time getting actual applications for bettering the lives of people, not just the state of Minnesota, but the world globally, overall. And also on the education side, you know, as President Cato talked about, the learning and education being a key part, and making education affordable for every earning level household in the state of Minnesota. And I think it's an important factor to be able to open up doors for the Minnesota youth overall. And the efforts in terms of working with the legislature to give another $42.5 million to be able to have the scholarships, and another $45 million to be able to do the research required on robotics and brain-related illnesses, and the microbes that get rid of certain germs that are in the human body, in the soil and water, and those elements. So there is tremendous approach to be able to do good both internationally and statewide for the research, and also focusing on learning and teaching. And also doing teaching in today's technology with better engagement in the class and bringing it to date rather than lecture notes, take notes, go study, memorize, and come back and write in tests. I think those are happening. I know Tom Fisher in the Design Institute, who's the dean, is using this methodology. I just talked to him a few weeks ago, where he videos his classes during the summertime, and the kids actually watch the videos before the class and learn about the subject matter. And the classes are total discussions and engagement and dialogue. And that's the value of the time that he's using versus just writing notes. So those are some of the elements overall to your first question as relates to what the university can do to better the education, better the state's economy, research, and all of those elements. And the second question is,
how does the university work with the Minsky system and the private colleges to, in essence, in a coordinated way, achieve the same?
Thank you. You know, I think with the Minsky's president, also a former University of Minnesotan, and I think there is opportunities to work together to reduce duplicity in investments and also in efforts, either through research or through education, and so that we are looking at the state as a whole gaining rather than individual pieces. So the total itself can be more than the total of its parts overall. And I see those as opportunities as the regions could also pursue and recommend approaches to work with minuscule systems, both for efficiency purposes in terms of costs related, and also due to some of the positive outcomes as a result of those efforts.
Thank you.
Margaret?
There was a Wall Street Journal article, I'm sure you read it, about the University of Minnesota management, heavy administrative cost. I'm going to ask you two questions. One, what did you think of the article? But number two, if you'd been on the Board of Regents and President Kaler called you in, the SWAT little team, and said, how should we respond to that? Mm-hmm. What are your answers to that? First, the article itself, which was the underpinning of too much bureaucracy in higher education, and then sort of the university's response to that. What did you think of that?
You know, I actually read an article that President Kaler has responded to that article in the Daily magazine or the Daily newspaper that University of Minnesota has. I think the article that was out there was using some of the media that has been touting some of the administrative costs that were high. You know, the devil is in the details. If you look at the details of where the university was in 10, 11, 12 years ago versus now, and university has, and my statistics may be plus or minus 2 or 3%, and has 16 to 18% more students, but doing it with same amount of money they did in 2000, 12, 13 years ago. And there has been many efforts during President Brunick's also in consolidating the colleges and trying to bring together the best of the best, both in terms of resources and professors. And there is, I'm sure, still more opportunities, as we talked about, some of the combination of things that could be done with the other colleges as well. But overall, I think, as President Kaler talked about as a rebuttal to that, and he gave these statistics, and also saying that there is more opportunities for us to work on further efficiencies. And he did not describe what those efficiencies are. You know, I think as part of the regions, I will help form a commission to study and look at benchmarking of other universities of this size and look at some of their methods. And also, part of the challenge here is some of the administrative people are lumped into a group that other universities may have it as in other buckets. And I think the truth needs to be told in terms of what the real comparisons are, and then do some benchmarking to fully understand what more opportunities exist in terms of more effective and efficient management.
George?
Mr. Tushu, where do you see the university in 3 to 5 years related to online education?
You know, online education has been touted as a panacea. And you can see many online universities that came to the scene and are struggling right now. There is a place for the online education within the university, as I talked about Tom Fisher's element, or bringing other professor lectures that may not be able to travel here. But the experience of being a student on the campus and having that experience of living there with other students, learning from each other, and being able to establish lifelong relationships and friendships, and looking at each professor and their friends eyeball to eyeball and being able to talk and converse with them about affairs other than functional knowledge has a lot of value. And I think technology has opportunities for us to enrich the education system. But I'm not a believer of online universities as a substitute to the experience of going to a university like ours, University of Minnesota.
Thank you, sir.
Sonia, and we are probably nearing the time of one or two more questions, okay. So we're getting close to the end.
All right.
Thank you. I'm interested in hearing about a specific example in which you were a member of a team, not in charge. You were, as a group, dealing with a complex set of issues, and you were able to move the group successfully toward a conclusion that worked for all.
Okay. This is actually an exercise I teach. It's called action learning. And I'll give you an example of it, and with an example, hopefully I'll be able to explain to you what the process is. In Select Comfort, I have 7 executives that I'm working with. And their CEO had a enterprise-wide challenge for them. And the enterprise-wide challenge is innovation culture. How do we establish innovation culture at Select Comfort? And Initially, I took these seven executives to Ohio Fisher MBA School, as they are known for their Innovation Institute. And we spent 2 days in understanding what innovation is and isn't, and learn about certain innovation approaches as relates to food industry and also some technology industries. They got grounded in the subject matter itself at first. And then I took them out to an offsite for 2.5 days, locked them up. And at first, we had to define the challenge, the problem. And then the goal had to be defined, problem to goal. That took a day and a half for us to actually, and also, by the way, the only way they could participate is asking questions, not pontificating, not making comments.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
And therefore, you go through a divergence process of you can only answer questions as an answer to a question, not just to say, I think. Mm-hmm. And as a result of this process, we're able to define what the problem was and what the goal is. And then the rest of the day, we went through a brainstorming process, which I call diversification. Any idea is a great idea. They came up with 68 ideas to take us from point A to point B, from problem to goal. And through categorizing those, then we did a convergence element of coming to 3-4 things that they felt is possible to be done, and with tactics and phases of what those would be. Phase one was very key, leadership challenges. Number two was cultural challenges. Number three was tactics. And this was presented to the CEO and to the executive committee, and they accepted the challenge and what was put forth. So it takes time, but through a good group of people, getting into a room, understanding the objective, understanding the challenge, brainstorming, and spending the time, there are ways and also some leadership tactics and tools that we can help come up with a vision and help to get there as an end result. So I hope I answered your question.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes, Jennifer.
Sir, could you comment a little bit about how you played a role in your corporate leadership functions in increasing access for people of color and women?
Yes. Well, at first, the retail organizations are very fortunate because we had 75-80% women in the organization. And it attracts, retail character-wise attracts. And, you know, part of the elements of diversity is something that I quoted to my teams is, if you have biases, you leave the bias at the bus stop before you check into your business. And biases are not acceptable of any sort. From a college hiring to a certain hiring practices that we looked at, not quotas, but really trying to be able to represent the communities we were working in, in terms of the mix of our employees and the team members. And as they came aboard, mentorships are very important to be able to, it's not just recruiting, but to be able to retain them. It was very important for us to be able to assign mentors along the way for them to feel comfortable, to have a mentor to go to and talk to. And really, overall, I would like to say it's more so inclusion than diversity understanding. Inclusion meaning including everybody in decision-making processes and understanding what's important for them and giving them those tools that are important or those relationships that are important for them to be able to help them excel in their environment. And it also helped me that I speak with an accent, that they know I am totally diverse and come from a diverse perspective and value diversity and no biases against of any kind, gender, religion, sex. Even at a time when the Data National Corporation took on the GLBT, and I volunteered to be the executive sponsor, and a few of my friends said, are you sure you want to do this, as you may be thought as one of them, as they said. And I said, I'm sure of myself. I don't have to prove to anybody. And so I chaired that group proudly.
Thank you for answering our questions. I would like to invite you to make a closing comment. And we actually didn't maybe ask as many questions of you. We kind of ran out of time. If there's a question you thought we should have asked, this would be a good time to share that as well. So.
I think overall the diversity aspect is a very important one. For me, and I think Jennifer asked me a question about that element of it, and what I would do. And also, there was one more question. And I really feel in this global environment, if you look at what's happening around the world, and the one thing I believe that is the problem today in our world is lack of understanding of each other. And lack of leadership. And when I was talking to Bill George in one of his seminars, and he had come from a international leadership seminar, and they concluded that today's global problems is due to bad leadership and not understanding cultures. So that is my passion, to teach and coach leadership and also bring to the table a diverse thinking and also an understanding of different cultures and religions, and help the university to be a more diverse thinking organization in their decision-making process. So I would have asked that question.
Okay. About diversity. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And my closing comments, hopefully I was able to paint a picture for you about my background. I'm sorry I got emotional a little bit as I talked about my crucibles, and those are life learning lessons. But
no reason to apologize.
Thank you. I faced many adversities throughout my life, as I've indicated from a childhood on. But I am very much achievement oriented and people oriented, and you could not achieve anything without people, and I bring to the table people orientation, people understanding, people coaching, and people loving. And combined with that love of people and getting things done through people, and I can bring to the table that passion combined with understanding of global approach to education and also leadership. And those are my strengths. And although I have 2 engineering degrees, I believe I have a whole brain, not just a left brain or a left brain. And my IQ intelligence is equal to my emotional intelligence. And that's an important part at the stage of my life to be an effective leader going forward. Thank you very much for your time to ask the question, to listen to me. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.